Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Initiatives podcast. I'm Oliver Hartwig. Today I'm joined by our research fellow, Max Salmon. Hi, Max.
Hey, Oliver.
We want to talk about your new paper. The paper is called Cabinet Congestion, and it's the growth of a ministerial maze. Great title, by the way. We should probably explain a little bit where all of this comes from. And that's a story that I picked up during last year's coalition talks. So during the negotiations, one of the three parties, from what I have heard, and I won't reveal too much, was discussing the creation of a few more ministerial portfolios. And at the time, I thought to myself, you must be kidding, because don't we have enough already? And then I mentioned that to you, we discussed it a bit further, and out of that came this paper that you have just produced. And it's a fascinating paper because it actually documents something that most people would not even be aware of, and that is just how complicated New Zealand's government has become. So the whole thing is called cabinet congestion, but Max, let's just clarify a few things first. This is not really about the number of ministers, the size of cabinet. That's not quite what it is. So what is it?
Well, it's really about the complexity of the organization of New Zealand's political executive. So the executive is the branch of government, the head, the brains, it makes the policy decisions, it calls the shots. Because in New Zealand, the executive is also populated by the leading members of the legislature, of parliament. It means that the executive controls so much of the state in New Zealand, if not everything.
So the executive, you mean the prime minister, the cabinet ministers and ministers outside cabinet and parliamentary undersecretaries.
And their departments as well.
Yes. Shall we just unpick this a little bit? So actually, how many ministers do we currently have?
So we have 28 ministers, 20 of which are within cabinet and 8 of which are outside of cabinet. And these are all full ministers. New Zealand doesn't have a junior minister role. If you're going to hold an associate portfolio, which is our equivalent of a junior portfolio, you have to be a full minister. You have to hold another full portfolio. There are parliamentary undersecretaries, but there are only 2 of those and they have a very, very limited purview.
Yes. So that is relatively large already.
Yes.
Even by international sense. I mean,
and when we first started looking at this, that was the first thing that popped out at me was I was immediately like, how can we figure this out? Let's make a comparative analysis. And so I went and found parliamentary democracies of a similar population size to New Zealand. And it really stood out, particularly the number of portfolios, 78 portfolios. We've pretty more than triple the average, but we've also got pretty much 50% more ministers, and we have many more departments as well, about 100% more departments.
Must say, I was a guest at the swearing-in ceremony last year.
Mm.
And
how long did that take?
Exactly. So I sat there, and the 28 ministers walked past and took their place at a long, long table, and at the head of it, of course, was the Governor General. And at that moment, I really realize quite physically actually just how big this executive is, and then they all had to individually swear their allegiance.
And this is important because when you consider what the executive does, it's meant to be the brain, the central function of the government.
And it's got a big brain.
But it's meant, there are so many things. There is the saying, too many chefs spoil the
broth.
Yes, it's a saying for a reason. And I think that there is like a really limiting factor. If you're trying to fulfill the purpose of the executive to make these decisions on the fly, to have this cohesive single unit governing the country, and you add too many people into there, you're going to get a lot of problems associated with that.
Yeah, and it becomes a lot more complicated still when you consider that you're doing this with 3 parties.
Oh, yes, totally. And also when you consider that a third of the ministers sit outside of cabinet, and cabinet is that main coordinating body within the executive itself.
And even some really important ministers, like the Minister for the Environment.
And Climate Change.
And Climate Change.
And for Education.
And they don't have a seat at the cabinet table.
No.
It's a bit odd.
It is. It's a bit strange, and like many things in New Zealand politics, there are informal workarounds, but those really depend on the personal relationships between ministers. And if those personal relationships don't exist, or they're strained, which is a totally reasonable thing to happen in a coalition government, then that really puts pressure on the efficiency of those ministers.
And by their very nature, these ministers outside cabinet are not high in the pecking order.
Yeah.
So, yep, they might have personal relationships, but they wouldn't really have much of a political standing.
Yeah.
At least relative to their more senior colleagues.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, so that's the first element. So we've got 28 ministers and undersecretaries. There's another element, though, and that's the ministerial portfolios. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have 78 now?
Yes, we have 78, which is the most it's ever been. But it's been a pretty steady increase over the last 100 years.
We have to explain this a little bit. What is a ministerial portfolio? It is not a department. It is not a minister. It's a portfolio. Give me an example.
A really simple example is education. So the education, the minister who holds the education portfolio is given the powers and responsibilities that come with running the nation's education services.
Everything.
No. So not tertiary education is a separate portfolio.
Okay.
So that is the, you are in charge of a wide variety of everything from managing the real estate portfolio of the schools. A lot of it's devolved down to boards, but ultimately the puck will come up to you. And education standards, teachers' pay, or everything you can imagine from primary school all the way through to the end of high school. And you're ultimately responsible for all of this. But that's quite nice and concise because there is a single education department and there is a single education portfolio and there is a single education minister.
So it's a huge portfolio.
But it's a massive portfolio.
But at least it's pretty clear who is responsible for what.
Yes.
Give me the opposite example.
So a good example is the tourism and hospitality portfolio.
Yeah.
So
also an important sector of the economy.
And very well. So a very important sector of the economy, but it falls into this category of portfolios that have been created that are very narrow and strangely shaped, and subsequently they overlap heavily with other portfolios. Tourism and hospitality really overlaps heavily with immigration and workplace relations. And in fact, if you
and local government, perhaps.
Yes, and local government. And so you have, it's not very clear cut at all. And it's not clear cut to the point at which the briefing to the incoming minister, which is the big document that ministers are given when they come into their portfolio by officials that explains how it runs. On page 2 or 3 of the briefing to the incoming minister, the tourism and hospitality briefing says that all of the issues that face this portfolio are the responsibilities of other portfolios.
Well, that's nice to know.
It's nice to know, but it really calls into the question of what the portfolio exists for at that point. They seem to, if you read through the BIM, it seems to be this hodgepodge mix of spending appropriations and really random stuff. Like the main spin seems to be on the private accommodation on dock walks.
Okay. So is the Minister for Tourism really just a link between the tourism sector and other cabinet ministers?
That's probably a very pragmatic and practical way of looking at it, but it does beg the question of if that role couldn't be filled by someone who was holding a wider portfolio that encompassed much more of what we'd actually think a tourism and hospitality minister would be doing.
And we've got plenty such examples where portfolios overlap, where they have something to do with each other, but they are separated. So the thing that comes to my mind is actually we have a separate housing and a separate building on construction portfolio.
Yes. And I think really what it comes down to, and I think perhaps the best way to explain to listeners, is if you imagine the Norwegian system in comparison. So in Norway, there is a single department for infrastructure, and then there is a single minister for infrastructure. And there is a single portfolio that minister holds. Mm-hmm. And so ministers, with rare exceptions, will only hold one portfolio, and that one portfolio will only cover one department, and that one department is covering a very clear and delineated sector. But when you have 78 portfolios, as we do, and 41 departments, and 28 ministers, the network of connections between all of these really does begin to look incredibly opaque and convoluted and almost like this tangled forest of conflicting interests.
And indeed, we have an infographic as an appendix of your report. I must say, actually, this is probably the first report we ever produced where I would recommend to readers to start at the back.
Yes.
Because once you have seen the infographic, first of all, you cannot unsee it.
Mm.
But then it really illustrates the rest of the paper and it tells you exactly what's wrong with it. Because the whole pattern of New Zealand government responsibilities and the flowchart of how we run this country looks like a knitting pattern. It's utterly confusing.
It looks so strange. It's almost a spider web. And it really does. I think a picture paints a thousand words. There's the Norwegian one underneath it. And the Norwegian one looks very similar to the Singapore or the Danish.
The US, yes. And Germany. So many countries actually run like Norway.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
No country runs like us.
No country runs as like us. And there is, of course, you're not comparing apples to apples. There are problems with comparative political analysis. Other countries have federal systems or much more devolved power to government. New Zealand's very centralized. But it's still, I think there is still clearly so much room to improve, even given those caveats.
So I would imagine that you pick Norway because it is a country of roughly comparable size.
Mm-hmm. And of a similar parliamentary democratic system.
And yet, you could have taken the US, and that's a country that's vastly bigger than New Zealand, and yet they have fewer cabinet positions in Washington, and the responsibilities are very much like in Norway. So one minister, one department, one responsibility.
Yes, yeah. Totally. And I think even when you account for the federal and state systems in America, the sheer population and political power and economic power residing in those portfolios is still astronomically higher than anything imaginable in New Zealand.
We need to talk a little bit more about this infographic because actually in my head while I was interviewing you, mm-hmm. I started on the right with the ministers.
Mm.
And then if we move to the left, we have the ministerial portfolios in your graph.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another one going further to the left, and that's the departments. And you already mentioned we have 41 departments.
Mm.
I mean, not just ministerial departments, but all sorts of agencies. And so you have these 78 portfolios now allocated to the various agencies, departments.
Mm.
And again, it is confusing.
Oh, yeah, incredibly. I mean, I have the infographic in front of me, and I encourage listeners to pull it up from the initiative website.
Really good eyesight.
Yeah, and you do, because and you will understand why when you see it. It is incredibly complicated, but if you just imagine a list of those 41 departments, things ranging from the Crown Law Office to the Ministry for Culture and Heritage, some of them are responsible to a single portfolio, but around half of them are responsible to multiple, and most of those responsible to more than two.
And the worst one
is MB.
MB.
16
the Ministry of portfolios. Business, Innovation and Employment. I think that was the official title.
Mm-hmm.
16.
Actually, no, it's 16 ministers. I'm not sure how many portfolios it reports to. Possibly more.
We could probably calculate, but we would need a microscope.
Yeah, to look at it. Certainly. Okay. But it's an incredibly complex super organization. And I want to be really careful here because I think at the end of the day, we're advocating for some sort of streamlining of government. And MB is an example of probably what not to do, where you've gathered together a wide range of vaguely similar policy teams, put them into one department, and then made them responsible to more than a dozen portfolios.
So really, in practice, what it means, you have this super ministry, MB, now on, I believe, 7,000 bureaucrats, roughly, and they serve, I don't know, 16, maybe 20 ministers. I think it was 16 ministers under the previous Labour government. I haven't even counted how many ministers they currently serve.
Mm.
And then that includes the associate ministers, of course, or they might be on top, who knows. But actually, MB basically reports to half the cabinet in some way or form, roughly. Probably a little bit more than half the cabinet. But that leads to an obvious question, and that's accountability. So imagine you have the chief executive of MB, and the chief executive of MB, of course, has to report to, well, a minister.
Mm.
But actually, in fact, the chief executive of MB is currently reporting to
16.
How would MB then be accountable properly to elected politicians?
Well, it's a good question. It's much more an issue of how MB is held accountable more widely for its deliverables. Because if you imagine that each minister has certain things that they want from MB, I just imagine the biggest problem is the CE becoming stretched incredibly thin. Like, imagine if a minister wanted a meeting with you once a month. It's half of your month booked out just meeting with ministers and you're running the government's largest department with its widest range of policy objectives.
No, let's just imagine, I'm not saying this is the current scenario, I'm just saying as an imaginary scenario, you have an MB chief executive and that MB chief executive is hopeless. Mm. Not just on the policy, but actually on the organization of the department itself. Mm. Now, you would expect in ideal circumstances, the minister to pay attention to that and actually hold the executive to account. But since it's now just one of 16 ministers, no minister would actually feel responsible for actually making sure that the department runs properly. Mm. So how could accountability really work, even in theory, given that scenario?
No, exactly. And I think like it's such a good argument for streamlining the current system. It's like it can't in such a scenario, and that is very plausible. It could really cause serious issues for the Wellington bureaucracy.
Okay, and then we've got the final complication, and that is we have these many departments dealing with policy issues that are actually also not that quite clear cut. So you've got some areas of the economy or areas of really policy making, and they are in themselves split between various agencies.
Yeah, totally. So I think, and doing a rough aggregate of these comparative countries that I mentioned at the start, you know, similar populations to New Zealand, similar political systems, you can really break down the areas of policy responsibility of the state into 15 categories. Mm-hmm. And these 15 categories are very broad benchmarks. So there'll be things like agriculture or culture or social security and so on. Very, very, very broad
education, defense.
Mm. And then these are then broken up into the 41 departments, which is really the, you know, the start of all our woes.
So we have whole areas split between various departments. Give me an example.
Right. So a great example would be environment. Mm-hmm. So environment is then split into the Ministry
For the environment.
For the environment, yep. MFE, Department of Conservation, DOC, yes. Ministry for Transport, yep. And Ministry for Primary Industries.
Sure.
And that's not including other non-central government or agencies and organizations, such as, let's say, the Climate Change Commission.
And you could argue that environment also includes loads of functions currently exercised by local government.
Yep, totally.
And local government sits within internal affairs.
And you begin to see, you know, you tug on one thread and suddenly you're pulling up half the government along with it.
That sounds incredibly complicated. I also wonder actually how the ministers themselves can deal with this complexity. So we already mentioned we've got building and construction and housing separated. We have defense and veterans affairs served by different ministers. So I'm not quite sure actually how the ministers themselves can organize these matters.
There are, for a few of the really big sectors, there are cabinet committees which exist for this purpose, but there's very few of them. I think there's only three or four. There is no real institutional answer. There is no structural answer. The answer is very personal and relationships-based between ministers. But then if you consider that with 28 ministers and 78 portfolios. I think the average national cabinet minister holds 3.4 portfolios plus an associate portfolio. Like, you can just imagine that it's an incredibly trying and draining job, and particularly if these are very separate portfolios. Like, I think Casey Costello holds customs and seniors, and then the associate portfolios for immigration, health, and police. None of these are particularly connected apart from the associate immigration and customs. And then it really brings to the front this issue that ministers have of stretch, where they're just pulled across so many portfolios that they can't really pay enough attention to any particular one. Something has to break.
Well, that's the other weird thing, actually. So ministers hold portfolios that have absolutely nothing logically to do with each other.
It's political expedience. And if you imagine that you're the Prime Minister and you're sitting down to chop up the proverbial pie of government, and you're looking across from you and they're your coalition partners, and you're looking around you and they're your own party partners, and everyone's loving the smell of this pie of government. They're really looking for a slice. And so you whip out the knife and you need to give the people across from you the bare minimum that they will accept, and the people around you, your own party, as much as you can possibly take. And so you get out the knife and you start slicing that cake into ever thinner wafers, and you just start handing out the bare minimum that the people around you will accept. And for it seems to be like a really good example of this is the racing portfolio. Like clearly at one point within, and this was before even MMP, but parties are still these broad churches, and someone went, right, well, this person is very interested in racing and wants a racing portfolio. We have a sport and recreation portfolio. We want to retain as much control as we can over sport and recreation. So we're just going to slice out racing and pull that apart. We keep the rest of the portfolio and they just get racing. And then you can just imagine this happens over and over and over again, because there is no check. Like you said, no one appears to have stopped to think and go, wow, this is an incredibly large number of portfolios now. Maybe we should consolidate them because it's politically expedient now. When you're the Prime Minister, you want to have all that cake pre-sliced up so that you can hand it around to people.
And then you've got very different types of ministers. So you mentioned Casey Costello with, I think, 5 portfolios that have little to do with each other. The opposite would be Tama Potaka.
Mm-hmm.
So Tama has Maori development as his main gig,
mm-hmm.
but he's got a few other portfolios that all have something to do with Maori affairs.
Mm.
So rather than realizing, actually, we've just given all of these portfolios to Tama, maybe it's time to consolidate this into one Maori affairs or Maori development portfolio, he actually holds them separately.
Mm. Yeah, and it is interesting, and I really think it comes back to this political expedience thing. Like, imagine that at some point Tama really puts his foot in it, and then the Prime Minister can take one of those portfolios away.
As it happened before with other ministers.
Yeah. And they take one of those portfolios away, or he'll be stripped of his excess associate portfolios, and then you can sprinkle those around the rest of your cabinet or the rest of your executive, and it works very nicely from a leadership perspective.
We should probably also point out something you write in the paper, that this is not a new phenomenon. The diagram that you just put together wouldn't have looked materially different under the previous Labour government. So this is something that has actually developed over the decades. I mean, in the 1950s, New Zealand looked a little bit more, well, straightforward, I would say, when it comes to the government organization. But really, at some stage, the number of portfolios, the number of ministers really took off. When was that?
Well, there was a bit of a jump between the Holland and Nash governments, but it's not considerable. It was just the slow divergence between the number of ministers, which kept steadily growing and steadily growing, and then the number of portfolios, which just grew at a steeper rate, and with fits and starts, but overall it's a pretty smooth curve. And it appears there was some attempt to bring that back down and under control under the Key government, not a very serious one, only chopping about 8 portfolios, but then it just bounced straight back with Ardern, and then it's risen to new heights under the current government. I think this is part of the problem, is this has been part of the political environment for so long that people just accept it as normal, and no one stopped to look at what's right in front of their noses and go, oh man, there's this massive, needless complexity in the most important branch of government, and surely that's having onflow effects for policy and ultimately for the rest of New Zealand.
So do you think there is a realistic chance of bringing this back to something a bit more sensible?
No.
No.
No. I don't think, I at the moment, I don't think so. And maybe that'll change. And I hope the report will generate this sort of discussion where it becomes much more normal to talk about among politicos. But I think there's the political expedience problem. I think there's also, this would be a massive bureaucratic reform.
I'm perhaps a little bit more optimistic than you,
mm-hmm.
which is unusual.
Yes. Yeah. Normally you're the office cynic.
Yeah. Well, I still am, but... I look at our Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, and I imagine after his long career in business, running divisions of Unilever and then, of course, Air New Zealand, he surely must look at this and think, well, are we mad? I would never run a company like that.
Mm.
I mean, he was, from all accounts, a typical kind of corporate manager, basically top-down hierarchy, giving orders and expecting other layers to basically implement.
Mm.
Now as Prime Minister, he would look at this and think, oh God, I've got 78 portfolios, I've got this myriad of government departments, and none of this is clear. So I don't have clear reporting lines. I don't have clear structures. I don't have clear hierarchies. How on earth could we run this properly? If I were someone like Luxon with that kind of business background, I would probably think, well, this is crying out for reform. I mean, Luxon has talked about being a turnaround manager and having experience in turnaround management. I would imagine this would tickle him and say, well, hang on, I have to do something about this.
Yeah, and look, and if he did want to do something about it, like we've said, there are lots of other examples of very efficient systems overseas. Sure, they have their flaws, but they provide a really good starting point. And I think that this really touches on wider reform issues of the New Zealand's political system as well. Like there's the issue that with 28 ministers, it's just over a third of parliament sits in the executive. This is all sorts of strange and negative onflow effects for the rest of our democracy.
The other thing I would say, though, is this is the kind of problem that you can't just reform incrementally. If you're just taking 3 or 4 portfolios away and reduce the number of ministers by 2 or 3 and maybe consolidate a few departments, I don't think that would cut it, and it wouldn't work that way because it would just take another term or two and we're getting back to where we were. I think if you really want to reform this, you need to take the kind of Gordian knot approach to it and really cut this down into its simplest form. Maybe take Norway as your guideline and ask yourself, actually, if we could start from scratch, how would we run this country?
No, precisely. I mean, I can agree more. I think that'd be a great starting point. And, but I also, you've got to consider that he'd have to do this with his coalition partners as well. I can maybe imagine ACT and parts of NZ First getting on board, but then you have like David Seymour has his regulation portfolio and these things that really signal to the voter base of these parties that they are doing things that they were elected to do. There's a big signaling method, so it's also you'd have to work out how you can incorporate some sort of alternative to that, whether that's like portfolios that are on a time limit that only lasts 3 years and then are then dissolved.
There's one thing that's a bit strange about the paper. It is so obvious what you're describing. Once you look at the diagram, you think, oh God, this is crazy. And yet, I've been in New Zealand for 12 years. This is the first time I actually see a discussion of this. And I always found this bizarre, coming from different countries, having different experiences. And I always thought, well, this is really peculiar, the way in which New Zealand is run. But I cannot, for the life of me, recall a single discussion of this until your paper.
There was a document back from 1996 where there was a big review done, very, very in-depth review done on the number of departments and how improvements might be made there. And it would appear that most of those, most of that feedback was put by the wayside. But there is an astounding lack of research, not only for New Zealand, but also I found once again, you have issues of comparative analysis and like a lot of the literature is from South America and how many of those systems are really apples for apples comparable, or even apples for oranges would be desirable at this point, comparable with New Zealand. And so there is a real dearth of solid academic research in the area, which I think is normally the starting base for this.
Final question. In the production of this paper, or after you've written it, you ran it past a few experts, so academics, ex-politicians, for feedback. What did they say? Did they? Is there something that they previously realized as a problem, or was it more like an eye-opener for them?
I think for the politicians, they had realized it was a problem, but it sat in the too hard basket because they were slammed. It's an incredibly demanding job. And these were cabinet ministers that we spoke to, and they agreed with what was in the paper and nearly all of the points. But there's this, you need to have cabinet on side, and that would have required sitting it's precious time, and time is money, and so on. So they really agreed that something ought to be done, some of them very, very strongly. And then the academics, a bit different, they agree that the problem in the broader sense is very, very much there, particularly with there's much more of a focus on departments. But a lot of the work in the paper is essentially saying, you know, we need to do further research, and this is supposed to be the starting point.
Well, that's what academics always say.
Yes. But there needs to be, and I agree, you know, if we're going to make a really strong case. But the problem is that there's several PhDs worth of further research to be done from this note.
But that's not the best case scenario, just a few more PhDs. What would you really like to see after the publication of that paper?
I think you've certainly make a compelling case. I'd like to see people in Luxon's office pick this up and talk about it and say this is something that needs to be done. I think from the media's perspective, there's definitely pieces to be made about accountability. And I just think from the general public's perspective, you have to understand that the executive feels very far away. And the Beehive, and it's in Wellington, and it's the small insider beltway town, and so on. But the flow-on effects are absolutely everywhere. They're the potholes in your roads, they're what your kid's learning at school, they are the upkeep of the dock tracks. Like, the hand of the state stretches into absolutely all aspects of your life. And if the head controlling this hand is chasing its own tail and tying itself in knots, you're going to be getting a worse deal.
So, Christopher Luxon, David Seymour, Winston Peters, if you're listening, here's an idea for you. Maybe think about it a bit further, discuss it with your many cabinet colleagues, and think about whether this is not something that New Zealand could do better. And if you want to get some ideas on how to consolidate, just look at Max's paper. It's on our website. And for now, thank you, Max, and congratulations on your first report for us.
Thank you, Oliver. My pleasure.